Welcome to Documentary Diehards, the show where three sports fans break down one 30 for 30 documentary each and every episode. Welcome back. I am Ren Clayton. Sam Anderson is here and Nick Rudolph. Guys, how's it going?
Really good, Ren. We're just talking about the weather. It's pretty cold out there today.
Yeah, already calling back to last week's episode. It is very cold. It's freezing. It's windy. Got to talk about it.
That's true. It's a perfect conversation filler, you know, and start a podcast talk as well. Yeah.
Especially since it's so relevant to our listeners in Germany. I was looking at we get so many listeners, but there is someone that has listened multiple times in Germany. I was listening, looking at the numbers.
No way.
Yeah, but
shout out to Germany, huh?
Yeah. What are they? Yeah.
Maybe. Wow. Are they the country that has the most listeners?
No. No. What the heck? No, that's Argentina, obviously.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Have you guys watched the NFL playoffs? That's kind of what's on top of mind for me, at least. Nick, what were your thoughts from this weekend?
Yeah. So I tried to watch. First off, it was Bengals Raiders, right? And then the Patriots Bills on Saturday. So mm-hmm. I was pretty disappointed with the Patriots Bills game, as I think you know most people were. I thought it would be a close matchup. Belichick or the brilliance of Belichick would keep them in it. But man, the Bills looked very good offense, and defensively too. Yeah, the Bengals Raiders was a great game. Had its own controversy, of course. I felt like the whole weekend was kind of clouded with a lot of controversy with especially with the refs and that sort of a deal. And then obviously shifting forward to Sunday, the play at the end of the game of the Cowboys. What are your guys' thoughts on that specific play with the QB draw and how that was executed?
Yeah, I guess I have mixed feelings on it. Initially, after I watched it, I really liked the play call because I was like, oh, I mean, the field's wide open. It gets you to the, the 30-yard line or so. Or he probably should have gone down five
I think yards he got earlier. Four.
Oh, the 24. Okay.
That's where he got to. Yeah.
Okay. So he probably should have gone down at like the 30. And there's 14 seconds left. And so that was my initial reaction. But then like the more I've read about it, the more like NFL, former NFL players or analysts who have been around the game a lot said, they always practiced as if you needed 18 seconds if the ball was thrown to the middle of the field or ran to the middle of the field to stop the clock, basically. And so it was probably just a bad decision on their part, or maybe Dak just ran a little bit longer than expected. And so I guess my mind kind of changed on it. What do you think, Ren?
Yeah, I don't know. What was interesting to me was afterwards they were reporting it was Kellen Mond that called it, and they were like laying out who called the play and the steps that it went through. So like they said, he called the play, McCarthy signed off on it. And then someone was saying, I don't know if this was commentary or not, that Dak should have checked out of it. That's maybe just someone's opinion. But sure. I think it's interesting just kind of going off of that is, you know, Mond is up for these head coaching jobs, right?
More.
More. I'm getting my Kellen's confused. Kellen
Moore. Backup Viking great, Kellen Mond.
Kellen Moore. He's up for some head coaching jobs. And so there's like so many assistant coaches in the playoffs right now, more than I can ever remember before, that are interviewing or are going to interview for head coaching jobs. And so it's weird, like on one end, it's like Kellen Moore might have did himself a disservice for his interview in a couple of days after that play call in his playoff game. And then vice versa, Raheem Morris, the D coordinator for the Rams, might have just earned himself more interviews. Like he got an interview with the Vikings but after it was announced that he had an interview for the Vikings after like his defense showed out on Monday night. So like it's interesting to see all these head coaching jobs and the availability and the assistant coaches that are all like in the postseason and how that's kind of playing out. It's wild.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I agree with you saying that. I thought, you know, initially I'm like, oh, this is genius. Like, you know, you need to, you know, or you, that's an easy way to get, you know, a couple yards, get you to where you have a better shot at it. But like, if you're going to execute it like that, I feel like you got to have like Dak running, you have the offensive line in like a flying V formation, basically just like running behind them, ready to get set right away. Watching the replay, some of the wide receivers were like walking or, you know, like very slowly, you know, jogging back to the line of scrimmage. So it just seemed like it was, you know, poorly executed, and Dak probably went 5 yards too long, like you were saying. So,
and he gave the ball to his center instead of the ref, which is a couple seconds for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ren, it is really interesting seeing all these assistants getting interviewed. And I feel like this happens every single year, but it's our attention is being drawn to it more because the Vikings are looking for a head coach for the first time in 8 years.
You're right. Yeah. And it's also interesting to see some of these teams, successful teams in the playoffs, like both coordinators are going for the same job, like the Cowboys. Their O coordinator and their D coordinator. I think the Bills, same thing, you know. But let's jump into our documentary that we watched. You want to do that, guys?
Yes. Let's do
it. It's titled This Is What They Want. It came out in October 29th of 2013, directed by Brian Koppelman and David Levine, and it is about Jimmy Connors, a 8-time Grand Slam tennis player. This takes place in 1991. The entire documentary centers around the 91 U.S. Open, Flushing Meadows, and it kind of just covers that tournament and the great run that Jimmy Connors had. This was his last kind of hurrah as he was making a comeback from an injury. He was 39 years old at the time. He had already won those 8 Grand Slams and tons of other tournaments. He was ranked 174th entering the tournament. So, you know, he's basically a former great player coming back. One last major Grand Slam basically is kind of the encapsulation of the storyline. And there's just along the way, there's tons of classic matches where he comes back and beats other players that are, you know, ranked higher than him, things like that. It does do a good job. This is one of my favorite parts about the movie, was that it did a good job of kind of showing the background of his life, like close to a perfect amount, I think. Like it was one of those kind of movies where it focused on the one event and then drew in, you know, flashbacks or whatever, interviews, sound bites from people from his past and things like that to kind of round up the story. But it wasn't like just a documentary about one guy and his from when he was born to when he retired or whatever. So I like that a lot about it. He ultimately lost in the semifinals, I think, of the US Open, and that kind of ended his run. But it's just kind of talking about his amazing run in that US Open. And big thing is he was very kind of animated and, you know, very, I guess, angry at times. You know, he's one of those guys that screams at the refs and stuff. So he's a very unique character, and that helped this movie with the entertainment factor. Sam, what are your thoughts on this one?
Like you said, I think he is one of the craziest characters that we've seen in all of these 30 for 30s. I was trying to think back to some of the other ones, but he definitely had one of the biggest personalities, I would say. A fiery competitor. There we go. Sorry. And so that was really fun to see. I had never really heard of Jimmy Connors. I'm not a huge tennis fan or historian by any means, but that was really cool to see. I also just really liked the layout of this documentary. Like you said, showing the 1991 US Open game by game, but then in between those games, hitting parts of his life and introducing us to who this great tennis player was. And I thought that was really well done. And like I always mentioned, the length of these documentaries, I thought it was the perfect length, 51 minutes. It kept my attention the whole time. Didn't drag on, got right to the point, and just told a great story. What do you think, Rudy?
Yeah, I thought it was a unique way of, you know, capturing this whole, you know, tournament. Obviously, that's what it was, you know, all about. But then also capturing his career, at least points that, you know, reviewed what, you know, who he was as a character. I feel like that drew in a different audience that wasn't a, you know, tennis-specific audience. I feel like did a good job of educating me and him as the player, as the person. It got good interviews of different people too. I always thought John McEnroe was always the angry guy yelling at the officials, but you know, clearly that wasn't, you know, he wasn't the only guy out there. And so it was just cool to see just how he was, how he competed, and how he was able to keep up with others. He kind of has the, you know, the Michael Jordan in him where he would, you know, make up a vendetta that he would have against the other person or against the official, and, or, you know, maybe just one thing would happen, as, you know, what happened in many of these events, that there was one call that was different. And even though, you know, the maybe the tennis ball was, you know, off or out of play, like, and he knew it, he was able to turn it into something that was going to motivate him to, you know, really turn the tides in the whole match. So kind of cool to see that.
Yeah, I really liked how it started. I mean, it started and then a few minutes in, we're right in this first match of the U.S. Open when he's playing Patrick McEnroe, John's brother. And that was just like an all-time like start, like scene to start. It really drew you in. It, you know, he was up, Patrick McEnroe was up 3-0, and then ultimately, or 2-0, I guess. And then he ultimately lost. But yeah, that was just kind of setting the scene for what was going to be the rest of this film. Obviously, Patrick McEnroe really didn't like him. John McEnroe, like you mentioned, really didn't like him. And yeah, they're, John McEnroe is probably the more famous one, but they're both extremely animated and like to let their opinions be heard. Jimmy Connors pointing at the umpire after each winner in that one was just like insane. Like I can't even imagine that happening nowadays. Like you get disciplined in some way. Like, I mean, I remember when like Serena Williams yelled something a couple years ago at the umpire, and then like she lost a point or something. It was crazy. And then, or she might have even gotten disqualified for saying something. Like, and this guy was like literally pointing at the guy every time he hit a winner, like screaming. And yeah, it was just
talking so much smack. The
official's seat, just like. Yeah. You know, the hair on the back of your neck is just up.
Well, the documentary did a really great job of just showing the official's reaction to him getting yelled at, you know, like it just him blankly staring at Jimmy Connors over and over and over again as the crowd is just erupting in the background.
And then he gets the whole crowd against the official too.
That has to be the most helpless feeling in the world.
And you're on that big stand and you're just kind of looking around.
Yeah, you're on a little island. Everybody hates you. When he, it was later, a different round of the U.S. Open, he was just, it might have been the last one where he beat Christine, but he was just like hip thrusting toward the crowd in celebration, like after I think he finished off Aaron Christine to get to the semis, and like that was an up and down one off again. And he was just like, I mean, he's an insane person in some of these moments. It's crazy. It was interesting when they asked him about these things. And he's like, yeah, I never apologize for anything. You know, he's one of those just like, I don't have anything to apologize for. I don't care if people don't like me. A little bit of cliche, but I mean, it's, yeah, it's an interesting point of view.
And the crowd just ate it up. It was easy to see why he was a fan favorite. Because a sport, especially like tennis, is just, you know, so strict and so by the book, and you are supposed to act a certain way, at least that's how it's been year after year and decade after decade. And he just comes in and acts the way that we were just talking about, and the crowd, I mean, I'm sure it got a lot of people interested in tennis who typically weren't, you know?
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, Nick, for example, would you have been a fan? Would you have been one of those people that were like, or would you have been like, oh, this guy is so mean to people. I don't like him.
Yeah, I probably would have been, like, in the moment, I feel like I would have been like, you know, this guy is a hooligan. Like, why is he making all this, you know, noise and yelling at the refs and whatever.
But, and then I would have been like, yeah. We've been watching it together, debating it. What about you, Red? Would you have been a fan?
I feel like I probably would have been similar. I think in these matches, especially the US Open matches, when it was like making a comeback, to like he's much more endearing probably than when he was like his first few years out on the tour. Like when he's making his comeback, yeah, there's so much more, like he's so much more easy to root for. And that's why people were just packing into the Flushing Meadows. Yeah, but so I would have probably jumped on the train then. I probably watching on TV early in his career when he's like being, I mean, he's kind of just being a dick a lot of the time, but I probably wouldn't have liked that. It would be my guess, but it's hard to tell just from what we little clips we saw. John McEnroe says he wished he had punched him. So that's that's pretty funny.
I think how much of a showman that he was, I would have liked, but once I saw him just being like so awful to the officials, I think it'd be hard to get behind somebody like that. He's literally for like 10 straight minutes is like, I'm 39 years old and you're going to ruin this for me.
I know. Yeah, it's extreme. And then there's some other even less redeeming things that happen at the very end. So we can go to the Aaron Krikstein match, which is like his good friend, right? That he trained with. He was younger than him, like 12, 15 years younger, but his good friend, he ultimately played him in the quarterfinals of the US Open there in 91. And it was running me a call. Like some people were fast players, some were slow. He like slow played him because Aaron Krikstein was known as being a very fast player in terms of, you know, grabbing the ball and serving quickly after the point ends, blah, blah, blah. He likes to play with pace. And so they counted it in the documentary. He had like, 66, you know, he goes to the towel 66 times. He couldn't get his racket out of his bag. Like it was all this bogus stuff. He like had to go get his knee like sprayed and massaged. And so like, and this is still done nowadays. You know, you see it every once in a while. It's just kind of, it's gamesmanship is what it is. And so you can have your opinion on that. But then, so ultimately he came back and beat Krikstein, who's ranked higher. Another comeback win, super emotional, did the hip thrust. And then they never spoke again. They were good friends before that. And they literally never spoke again. What's with that? And the documentary helped us to wonder why, like, had they spoken? Did they have a kind of postmortem after he beat him? And then later in the documentary that Aaron Krikstein revealed, yeah, he never spoke to me again. And you're just like, oh, this guy's not a great dude. Thoughts?
I don't even understand how you could just beat somebody like that and then just never even reach out to them afterwards, especially if you're good friends beforehand. I mean, that just makes no sense at all. And I think it kind of speaks to who Jimmy Connors is as a person a little bit. It's kind of like our second documentary in a row where, you know, same with John Spano, where they're interviewing somebody who doesn't seem like the greatest human of all time. And it's like when they're looking back at the time of the documentary or, you know, the subject of the documentary, they weren't a great person then. And then they're interviewed in today's day and age for the documentary and they're still not great people now. And so yeah,
no, it's just kind no of funny. Regrets.
Yeah, they double down on everything they did.
Yeah. For sure. And he does that a lot. He backs it up and, you know, just says like, that's who I am as a person. And so I guess I kind of respect the fact that, you know, he's just sticking to his guns and you could tell from the videos that that's who he's been the whole time, but still doesn't make it right.
And like we mentioned, the fans still, you know, at the very least, they liked him in the moment when he was winning and making these super big scenes. And in the US Open, Mike Lupica, I think was a newspaper writer, and he was interviewed and said that it was a sporting event that made the fans feel like they actually helped the outcome. You know, they helped him win, which is a, you know, very unique. I was just wondering your guys's, what sporting event or athlete has ever made you feel like that? Is that a thing? Like, has that ever happened? Nick, what are your thoughts on, like, I mean, there's obviously the only thing that guy could think of is like, you know, false starts, making inducing false starts and crowd noise in NFL games, like actually a literal like impact. And now this wasn't necessarily literal, but it was pretty obvious that he was feeding on the crowd's energy a lot.
I mean, all those times where I'm at baseball games and I'm like, hey, batter, 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 Kennedy, 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 swing, batter.
Yeah.
I mean, I always feel like that helped. But no, it's, I mean, other than, you know, a false start in a football game, like you said, or maybe if you're sitting behind the basket at a basketball game and you're waving your hands as they're shooting free throws or something like that.
Or if like the home team starts counting down the shot clock or something, and like, you know, 3 seconds ahead for the home or for the road team or something like that.
That's a good one. Those are very like practical ones. Like, is there any like phenomenons where you like felt as a fan, like maybe some of these fans felt? I'm trying to think. Or maybe just thought that other people were when you were watching.
Like, were they just, you know, kind of catch on to something that.
Yeah, that was just so visceral.
I would say when I went to the season opener for the Timberwolves 1 year, the year after Jimmy Butler tried to demand for a trade, and the whole crowd started booing. And by the third quarter, they were cheering for MVP chants for Jimmy Butler. And it just turned into like, everybody took over, like, you know, like it took everybody over as fans, as far as, you know, just now cheering for the guy because of the hilariousness of the situation. But
I forgot about that.
I don't know if that really fits it, but
I mean, it doesn't exactly, but it is. Yeah, that's
amazing. It's kind of like the everybody in the you know, arena now, you know, rallying behind one person.
I think in Rudy and I's sport of running, it you can see an impact a little bit more too when you're like cheering somebody on in a marathon or during a race. And most of the time it doesn't have a super big impact, but every once in a while you can actually see it have like a lift on either their, you know, their spirit, or maybe they're just energized by the fact that they see somebody they know, or, you know, want to look good in front of that person or something like that. So I guess that's the only other thing I can think of.
Yeah. Okay. Let's. Anything else? We can get to ratings if you don't have anything else.
That's all I've got.
Yeah, I don't have anything.
I'll start us off with a rating here. Like I mentioned, I thought it was a good documentary, a solid one. Really liked how it was formatted, and just learning about Jimmy Connors and you know, his unique run at 39 years old. To the semis of the US Open. I'm going to give it a 7.05 former world number ones, because at the beginning of the documentary, when they started the interviews, it seemed like every single person that they interviewed underneath of it, it said former world number one. There's like five or six straight former world number ones that they interviewed. And I thought that was pretty funny.
I'll go. I gave it a little bit higher. I said a 7.8 hip thrust for previous reasons that we mentioned. 7.8 just because I really liked how it was so compact. Like, it didn't really have any, you know, it didn't need the like fat trimmed off of it. Like, it was concise. There wasn't a whole bunch of extra. It wasn't too long, stuff like that. And also at the end, I didn't see coming that he was going to lose. In the semifinals, he got blown out 6-2, 6-2, 6-2 in the semis, and it abruptly ended. And I was like, oh, I thought this was tracking toward a win. I thought he was going to win the whole tournament. And so a lot of these documentaries get made about just championship moments. And I've said before on this podcast that it's nice when every once in a while, it's not always just the champions. And it's not that everybody needs to get recognized, but like, if there's a great story, who cares if it was a champion or not? So that was a great, to me, for someone that didn't know the result before, that was a nice little twist at the ending. How about you, Nick?
Yeah, I think I'm a little lower than you guys, probably because I just didn't pay enough attention during it to appreciate as much as you guys did. I had a baby on my chest drooling all over me and trying to take care of her, but
making
excuses. A dad brand, I guess. but I'm gonna give it a 5.55 intimidating finger points, because just the fiery competitor he was, it was a good story. I felt you know, it got me interested in tennis, which I don't really know much about tennis, or at least, you know, care to know a lot about tennis, so I feel like it still engaged me. Told me a story, helped me learn, and
I guess the tradition kind of continues of me ranking these tennis documentaries higher than YouTube.
Ren, I've I've been looking back the last three, you are the highest. So you're starting to take over my old spot.
Yeah, I'm too positive. That's I need to get more negative in my life.
Man, just watch the news.
Oh,
just kidding.
He
is the news.
All right, let's move on to our next segment, which is our Mount Rushmore, and we're gonna go with a fun one. It's always fun when we do food. We're gonna do gas station foods. Our top four favorite gas station foods. We'll draft them, and mine will be the best.
It can also be liquids.
Yes, any item you consume at the gas station. Well, yeah. Anyway, Nick, you go.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Nick, you're first, and then it'll be me, and then we'll go with Sam and Snake. Nick, you're leading us off.
Oh boy. Okay. Well, I'm just gonna go with. I'm just gonna go with some cookies. Because I have way too big of a sweet tooth, and if I go in a gas station, I'll just get some cookies.
What kind of cookies? Like, what are these gas stations?
Well, it depends on what gas station, I guess, you go to.
I've never got a cookie at a gas station.
But, yeah, I guess I would just go to Quick Trip. There's really only one gas station for me, so.
It's the only one you need to go to.
Right.
Right. Some.
Ren, have you ever been to Quick Trip?
What?
Have you ever been to Quick Trip?
Of course.
It just seems like one of those things. It just seems like one of those things that we'd ask you, you'd be like, no. Oh. I don't know why.
I only go to Holiday.
I'm insulted. That's like a rite of passage for anyone from here.
That's true. Yeah.
But
the brownie cookies from Quick Trip. I did that. Oh, yeah. Even though they're like 1,000 calories a cookie or whatever.
I was a little worried that both of you guys were going to have like everything on my list, but now I'm a little less because you said you had a sweet tooth and like I don't really have like none of my things are sweet. So
yeah, I've never gotten puffins from a gas station either.
I was legitimately going to say that same thing.
You can't buy puffins at a gas station. It's only in select grocery stores, okay? the peanut butter ones though. Yeah. Okay, my turn. Flaming Hot Cheetos, it's gotta be. They're so good. They're like the most addicting thing that I eat. Like, I have an addiction to them. So they're really bad for you. I just feel them eating like my stomach lining, you know.
I was gonna say, I feel like you don't go into a gas station like, oh, I'm gonna get some nutritious foods. You're like, I'm gonna absolutely wreck myself right now.
I already threw in the towel on the way in.
Exactly. You're like, I'm here for the convenience and to make myself feel terrible. So yeah. Here we go. Just and when you Flaming Hot Cheetos is perfect.
Yeah, when you see them, you can't. It's hard to pass them up for me. So yeah, I don't know. Anyway, Sam.
There you go. All right, I'm just gonna take this one, even though I know you guys wouldn't take it. I'm gonna go with coffee right off the bat because. I'd say about at least 50% of the time that I'm in a gas station, I'm going to get coffee because it's cheap. It's one of my favorite things. It's pretty consistent. You can go to BP, decent coffee, Quick Trip, good coffee, Holidays, decent coffee. You know, can't really go wrong. We're like, you can't say the same thing about everything at a gas station.
Good. Good for like road trips or whatever too. Yeah. I thought about that.
Absolutely. Especially with this weather we're having. No. All right, and then my second pick, I'm gonna stick with the Quick Trip theme here. I'm gonna go with the cheese filled breadsticks, probably the best thing. The hot food at Quick Trip in general is really good, but the cheese filled breadsticks are a game changer, and I almost always get them.
Never had them. Never heard of them.
No, I'm going to have to search those out.
Yeah.
They're so good.
All right. Maybe Quick Trip should get like a Michelin star or maybe a couple. Who knows? It sounds like they make like some of the best cuisine in the world.
It's up there. It's definitely up there.
My turn. Sunflower seeds. I'm surprised no one picked it by now. That honestly is probably the number one item that I get as far as just over my life, what I bought at a gas station, probably sunflower seeds. Perfect for the car. you just gotta get an empty bottle, and it's like the perfect car snack because you don't like fill up, your hands are free, it's perfect. You just store it in your cheeks like a chipmunk. It's great. So some giant sunflower seeds, just plain. I like plain or barbecue sometimes, but I'm just a classic sunflower seed salted guy.
That's a good one. It keeps you entertained on a road trip.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had a sunflower seed.
What?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Why?
Just never. I was too busy with that Chubba Bubba bubble gum or whatever. With
baseball, the big league chew too. Career.
Yeah, the big league chew. That's what it was.
Wait, that surprises me. Wow.
Yeah, but I never had sunflower seeds. I don't know.
Oh,
maybe I associated it with a tobacco chew and just thought it was bad.
That's why I think I started it. It was because like, oh, I'm cool. Like I can't have tobacco as a little kid, but I want to have stack my teeth full of seeds.
All right, Ren, you ready for this one?
Yeah.
Hannah eats the full seed.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I know a couple people that have done that, and it's triggering. It's triggering, to be honest. It's such a lack of respect for the seed, if we're being real. But I do understand wanting, if you put one in, like if you have a whole cheekbone, then that's insane because they'll get soggy and you can't chew the shell. But if you just put one in, I can it is doable. I've done it before, but it's a kind of a crazy person.
That's what I tell her too. Not about that.
No.
And that's half the fun is like spitting it out, you know?
Yeah. And cracking it, making it's a nice clean, you know, crack pick. And yeah.
Nice so. Clean pick of the actual seed.
Yeah. Out of the shell. The shards of shell mixed in. Yeah.
It's an art really.
It is.
I wouldn't understand. All I know is even I wouldn't eat the seed though.
All right,
Rudy.
All right, I'm gonna go with nacho cheese bugles.
Wow.
For some reason, I tried it one time or something. It would just like hit different compared to original bugles. And I only get them at the gas station. Never have gotten them at the store or anything, and just destroy a, you know, a bag or whatever once you're driving.
I don't know if anyone in the history of the world has ever described bugles as hitting different.
Nacho cheese hits different.
Yeah, it's like one of those sentences never before said.
We just accomplished. Right here at Documentary Diehards.
You heard it here first, folks.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, what's third?
And then third, yogurt pretzels or yogurt covered pretzels. I think those are a really tempting thing for me at a gas station that, again, I just destroy once I get in the car with them. But yeah, kind of that sweet salty mix.
That's good. Like especially like the bugles thing. I'm going to go with Funyuns. Mm. And it kind of just falls in the category of something that you would buy at a gas station, but like you would never even consider buying it anywhere else. If you see it anywhere else, you're like, that's kind of gross. Like at the grocery store, you're like, why are people selling this at the grocery store? You only buy it at the gas station when you're in the car. I mean, Funyuns are kind of gross, but they're also really addicting. I feel like I haven't really had them in a long time, but I feel like that was like when I was younger, that was what you would get at the gas station because it's like it felt like they only were there. It's like, oh, this rare commodity at the gas station. And it's such a weird thing too. It's like this onion ring flavored chip thing. But so that's my pick.
I don't think I've ever had Funyuns.
Oh.
Right.
I would recommend it, but I also wouldn't. So it's just kind of weird.
Ren's list is actually just things Rudy's never eaten, not gas station. All right,
actually that's funny because like I have maybe had Flaming Hot Cheetos like maybe 5 Cheetos in my lifetime or something. So
wow,
how you, so disappointed.
How could you have 5 and not and stop yourself there?
I don't remember it at all, but I know that I don't like spicy stuff, and so I don't think I've really ever looked into it just because Flaming Hot sounds pretty spicy, so.
All right. I am going to go. I just thought of this one. I'm changing it up. You know those really long Laffy Taffys?
Really?
They're like cylinder shaped.
Oh, maybe.
And they're like a foot long. You don't even know what I'm talking about. That's how rare these things are, you guys. And they're usually like at the.
Not over here listening to you.
Does she know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like when we were kids, they're like a quarter. And so you could go in and with a buck and get four of them, and it was awesome.
So 4 feet of Laffy Taffy, and you just pound 4 feet.
It's probably like pretty close to a foot if I had to guess, yeah.
So 5 foot tall Sam walks into the grocery into the gas
station. I want my height in more taffy.
Oh, absolutely. And they're amazing. And it's like one of those things where you could probably get them at grocery stores and stuff, but I only really remember them from gas stations. I haven't seen them in a while, but definitely a gas station thing for sure. Then the other one is one of my go-to snacks when I'm just, anytime I'm like, I can go for like some candy or something when I'm stopping for gas or on a road trip or something, I'm usually looking at M&Ms and specifically peanut M&Ms. Talk about something that hits a little bit differently on a road trip, yeah. You know?
Much
choking hazard on the road trip.
That's true. It's worth the risk, in my opinion.
All right. My last one, you guys are going to hate this. Okay.
I'll bring it on. Let's go.
I'm gonna say apple juice, whatever, just the one serving bottle of apple juice. But I have an explanation. So you know how my second pick was sunflower seeds, you have to get a bottle. So generally my routine at the gas station, if I'm going to get a snack, sunflower seeds, chug an apple juice, and you got a spitter for your seeds. And I was going to say like an orange Gatorade. I've done that before, but apple juice is easier to just chug because it's smaller and it's not as like sugary or whatever. But yeah, and it's also really good. And I don't really buy apple juice in general. I'll buy other juices like orange juice or whatever at the grocery store, but I'm not going to buy apple juice, but I'll buy apple juice at the gas station. So there you go.
Rudy, have you ever had apple juice?
I have. I've never gotten it from the gas station though. So.
You should try it. It hits different.
All right, bring us home.
All right. I have got to go with, I'm kind of debating between two ice cream options, but I'm going to go with a Snickers ice cream bar because you walk out or right before you walk out of a gas station, you always see that, that cooler.
Oh, yeah.
The cooler of heaven. And it's either that or a chip burger for me or one of those chocolate chip sandwiches, ice cream sandwiches. But yeah, either one of those is a good go-to.
But yeah, you're describing the routine of it. I've always had beef with that ice cream thing because it is usually you see it after you pay.
Yeah, you do.
So are you going to be the clumsy person that's like, oh, wait, stop, don't ring me up. Or, oh, I need to actually ring this up again and get in line. It's just, my anxiety won't let me go there. I'm just looking away and walking out.
I already have my 4 feet of Laffy Taffy, but can I also add on some ice cream?
Need a little more sugar.
Yeah.
And then you risk dropping your apple juice all over the place.
Yes, spilling.
All right. For Mount Rushmore of gas station foods, Rudy went with cookies, nacho cheese bugles that hit different, yogurt-covered pretzels, and Snickers ice cream bars. Ren went with Flaming Hot Cheetos, a tin of Copenhagen, sunflower seeds, Funyuns, apple juice. I'm just kidding about the tin of Copenhagen. I went with coffee, cheese-filled breadsticks, Laffy Taffys, the foot-long ones, and peanut M&Ms.
I feel like these all kind of fit from what we've learned about each other's food habits in the past. I mean, not exactly, but they make sense, I guess.
Basically, when we walk into a gas station, we're all looking at different stuff, is what I've learned.
We won't even, if we were all in the same Quick Trip, we might not even see each other because we're all in different sections.
That's true.
All right, let's move on to our next segment. And Sam this week is going to give us his idea for a future documentary that he would like made.
All right, gentlemen. My idea is for a documentary to be made about Jackie McMullen. And the reason I say that is she's probably one of the best journalists that we've had, or sports columnists that we've had in our lifetime. She mostly covers basketball, and I think she worked for the Boston Globe for a long time, Sports Illustrated for a while, ESPN, and she also has collaborated with some of the biggest stars of the NBA to write their own biographies, or autobiographies, I guess. Larry Bird, Gino Auriemma, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and Shaq. She's been on Around the Horn, which is one of our favorite shows, at least one of mine growing up. And she's just one of, like, she's on Bill Simmons' podcast a lot, which I've listened to pretty regularly over the last couple of years. And I just love listening to her talk about the NBA because she is one of those old school journalists who really, like, built relationships with the players. And it's something that I think has gone away recently with players' ability to tell their own story on social media. It seems like it's not as common to really get to know the athletes as well as Jackie McMullen did in her lifetime. And she talks about that quite a bit. And I would just love to hear some of the stories. And every once in a while on the Bill Simmons pod, she'll tell like a crazy story about a time that she was on a road trip and talked with a player or something crazy happened. And I just think that the documentary or even like a book, if she wrote it, would be fascinating. And she recently just retired as well. And it's, I think might have a podcast coming on The Ringer. So yeah.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, I agree that she really is one of the most respected. And when she retired, you saw everybody saying the same thing. Like, she seems like a really nice person, and she's always super legit on Around the Horn. That's when I first was introduced to her a long time ago. And several years ago, I looked up her like on Wikipedia, and yeah, like all those, you know, credits, whatever you want to call them from her past. Yeah, that would be fascinating. And yeah, it would be cool if there were more, you know, like centered around these longtime, you know, reporters, because they, you know, they obviously tell stories for a living. So, you know, it can help but be entertaining.
And I think it would also be awesome just because, you know, she was a woman in a male dominated field, especially back when she started, which was probably, I would say, in the 80s. You know, it was probably what, 95% men in those locker rooms with the players. And just to stick with it, and I'm sure some like she's probably had some trying times because of it, and you know, to tell the stories that she's told and build the relationships that she has, it would just be awesome.
Yeah, I agree, that would be very interesting.
Sweet, great idea. You'll have to produce it in a couple of years. Once you work for The Ringer or whatever you're gonna do, I think that's
important. Yeah. Once the Doc Diehards check hits, then yeah, it's I'll coming. Start producing.
Mm-hmm. All righty, that about rounds us up. So we're gonna go to our looking forward to next week. Sam, do you have what to look forward to for our next episode next week? What documentary are we watching?
I do. We are on episode 57. Which was made in November 5th, 2013. It's called Bernie and Ernie. It's a profile of Bernard King and Ernie Grunfeld, their decades-long relationship and their on-court partnership on the University of Tennessee basketball team, better known as the Ernie and Bernie Show.
Wait, when was this? Did I miss when it was? Because it's obviously a play on Bert and Ernie, right? From Sesame Street?
Yes. It looks like Bernard King was born in 1956, so I'm guessing probably mid-70s would be when he would have been in college.
Cool. Well, we'll go back to college basketball. Rudy's excited. I can see him jumping up and down over there. All right. Thanks for doing this, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Stay warm.